You know all those registration drives that you hold, that you're trying so hard to get 10 people in a supermarket to register? Well, guess what? Once these people are elected, they're just being like, okay, those 20,000 people, oh, there's too many Gonzalez's on the list. We're just going to purge them right off. And the purging story was not being told.
Hello. This is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Ellen Kurz is founder and president of iVote, a voting rights advocacy group that campaigns to elect Democratic secretaries of state. Not everyone knows that in most states, the Secretary of State administers elections and that the Republicans have been using this power to suppress the vote. But that tactic probably won the election for Brian Kemp over Democrat Stacey Abrams in Georgia recently and has cost us many other races as well. Ellen and iVote are also working to pass automatic voter registration, and she recently wrote an editorial calling for the end of voter registration in general. Ellen has a good story to tell, a long and interesting career in which she's worked for numerous Democratic presidential campaigns, a variety of nonprofits, and many other endeavors. We met recently in Washington, D.C. to catch up about her life in politics and her work with iVote to help Americans fully secure their voting rights. It was a good conversation. You should take a listen.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Would you mind introducing yourself, giving me a quick biography?
My name's Ellen Kurz. I am the proud mother of two grown-up children. I am currently the president and founder of iVote, which is a campaign organization for voting rights. I have a long history in politics and another history in nonprofits and business. And I'm not sure which part of that you want me to elaborate on.
Let's start out by just tell me, like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City and then Nyack, New York. I had two wonderful parents who were Jewish activists who taught me everything and gave me every value that I have, that you're put on earth to basically see what you can do to help other people. And my parents are definitely the two most important people. They're both passed away now, lived their life every day with a set of values that I inherited, and I was the luckiest person in the world to have had them be my parents.
Kind of feel the same way about my parents. What are some of the core things that you took from that childhood and that upbringing?
Was that you're supposed to think all the time about what you could do for other people, whether it be your neighborhood, your family, your neighbors, or what you're going to do with your life. So my parents directly affected why I, at the age of 18, became a community organizer and worked in a neighborhood center. My parents were marched in the original, went to Selma, and they were against the Vietnam War from an early age.
What did they do?
It's so ironic. My dad, who was so left of center and was just working different jobs, working for an uncle who ran a radiology company, working at Macy's. And when I was about 8, he said, you know, I think we just don't have enough money to support our family. My mom was a social worker who worked at an agency that gave free services to very poor people. He decided to start his own annuities and life insurance company, which is so, you know, you're going to think, oh, that's like capitalism and horrible. But it wasn't. It was an incredible company, and he built it very, very slowly. And it took a very long time to become successful. But that was like out of necessity to provide. And the values continued in how he operated his company, treated his employees. And he won an award in the country for having like the most ethical company, blah, blah, blah. And Clinton brought him to the White House. He was an amazing human being. So I got these values from my parents. It was understood that I had these people skills and that I should use them to help other people. Like that was just, it was like part of the deal of being with my family. And I remained so close with them. I was with my parents all the time, spoke to them, my father and mother almost every day. So when I left home, I originally went to Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, which at the time was a mill town that was really dying. The factories had left and it was very run down, like really very desolate, decimated city. It's actually the second largest city in New England. And I remember my dad dropped me off and there was like drug addicts on the corner of the university and like everybody looked like they just had been like, there was something very wrong with them. And he was like, are you sure? You sure about this? And I was like, sure. And I just went to school, but I immediately felt like college wasn't fitting for me because I was like, all I'm doing is reading. I'm not really helping anybody. I'm just like studying and like drinking beer with friends. This isn't really productive. So I dropped out and worked in a neighborhood center in Worcester. And believe me, Lord knows, in those days, Worcester needed every kind of help it could get.
How long did you do that?
I stayed in Worcester and worked at various jobs, rape crisis center and various jobs, running voter registration drives and community organizing for 4 years. And there was like a...
Was that college for you or did you then go on later, to college?
I never went to college in a typical way. I have a degree from a New York University and also a master's degree from Harvard. But I always worked. So I went back to school at NYU, but I was working at the time for a leading feminist in the women's movement. Her name was Susan Schechter. And she was kind of the definitive person or author or thinker on violence against women in the country at the time. She came out of the Chicago rape center movement history. And she had this whole thesis that violence against women was economic and wrote a couple of books on it and how battered women really don't have any choices. But I was lucky enough to get a job working for her and work my way up to being her aide. And that was just a mind-blowing experience. And I got my degree at night. So I never had a typical college experience because I couldn't tolerate it.
What did you study at NYU?
I studied psychology and government. Mm-hmm. And then I have a master's degree from Kennedy School of Government in public policy.
Did that come right after that or a lot later?
No, a lot later. Yeah. I went into campaigns right after. I started registering voters at the Henry Street Settlement in my spare time. And I had done that in high school, and I had done it when I was in Worcester, as just not as a job, but as a fun thing to do on a Saturday. So I got very heavily involved in that, in the Henry Street Settlement, registering voters in black neighborhoods, and I just loved it. Like, once I started being in the voter registration world, that was like I found my calling.
Was it about empowering these people or was it about getting an electoral result that was more fair?
I think when I was younger, when I was 20, it was about that it was super fun to meet people that I never would have met. You know, I never would have met them. I'm like a white Jewish girl from New York City and I'm in Worcester. I'm in, you know, New York meeting people that are not, I wouldn't have met them. I wouldn't have been able to talk with them. Mm-hmm. And I love people. I just love meeting people and being with people. And I think that that is the passion in my life, is how much my love of just all different types of people. And it grew over the years into other things, but I would say that still to this day, I could say I've been luckiest person because I did eventually go into political campaigns through the voter registration work and had a long life in political campaigns, that I have been so lucky because I have friends 30 years, 35 years all over the country, Latino friends in Texas that I worked on a Southwest voter registration drive 30 years ago. I have friends that I worked in Iowa for 2 years, and that kind of friendship can't be forged anywhere else except for war. I have collected and kept and nurtured lots and lots of people who, how would I ever have met them if I didn't do what I did in my life? And it's been the people that I've met and learned from, and I really have the privilege of calling my friends, have been the best aspect of my life, besides my children and parents. So that's really corny, but true.
So what was the first big campaign you worked on?
I worked for Ted Kennedy in 1980 in New York City, when he in at the convention, mm-hmm. and then I worked
when
for
he made the amazing
yes.
speech that,
and then I worked for Barney Frank when he had his really big challenge against Margaret Heckler in Massachusetts, alongside of 40 other people who I was like low person on the totem pole, and
most people start out there.
Yes. If people these days that worked on campaigns saw the way we did it in the old days, I don't know what they would do.
It was less efficient in certain ways.
It was super fun. I mean, the reason that I went into politics, or that I've done anything with part of my life in politics, is very, very mission driven. And I'd say the mission over time became that the best way to effect change would be to elect people that would write laws that impacted people. And of course, presidential campaigns were the sexiest and felt the most important at the time. I don't think they are as much now, except for Trump. But when I was in my 20s, I thought that presidential campaigns were, oh, that's the most important, the Kentucky Derby, you know?
Most people in politics have had one presidential candidate they really fell in love with. Was there one like that for you?
I think I've loved all the candidates that I've worked for. I wouldn't have done it. I'm from the Triassic era. So I worked for everybody in the 1980s and then Bill Clinton. So George McGovern, when he ran for president the second time. Mm-hmm. And then when he dropped out, I worked for Walter Mondale. And then I worked for Mike Dukakis for the whole 2 years he was running, and then for Bill Clinton, and then, of course, for Barack Obama in 2008, helping with, in a different capacity, not as a full-time staffer, but helping with superdelegates, and then for Hillary Clinton. I don't know if I could choose between them. I really, really admire all of them.
What sort of roles did you have with those campaigns?
I was Get Out the Vote director in 1988, and field director. In 1984, I was deputy campaign manager for George McGovern, and then I was, this is super embarrassing, but Connecticut state director for Walter Mondale.
Yeah.
Mondale in the general. Oh, so we lost by quite a few votes.
It's a Reagan.
In the double digits, yeah. So I was just used to losing presidential campaigns, so this whole idea that we could actually win one was surprising. But in between, I did a lot of other things, and all in this kind of increased participation world. Mm-hmm. I started a couple of organizations that were nonprofits that did voter registration. I started the League of Rural Voters. I helped start the Center for Civic Participation. And it was all about, for me, it all crystallized in my mind to be that if we could get more people to participate, we could get the changes that we wanted, no matter what the issue was. Gun control, being so frustrated that we can't move the dime on some of these issues that the American public even agrees with us on. I just looked at the problem when I got to be in my 30s and 40s as totally related to turnout. And now there's consensus on that. But at the time, I'm not sure everybody was focused on that. And I still believe that. I mean, on my bio, it says true believer in participation to change the country. Getting to 100% is the answer. Getting to 100%.
Requires a certain amount of faith in the electorate that is sometimes merited, not always, right?
I probably have more faith than other people that that if we didn't have to spend so much time on the process and we could spend our time and money and energy talking with people in the country about the issues they care about, that we would have some slam dunks. So that's the biggest reason I founded iVote, which is something that I'm more passionate about than anything I've ever done.
Our last presidential election threw a lot of people into a depression or into activity. What was your lens on that, on 2016 and the Trump election?
It's probably the worst thing that's ever happened to me, besides anything like my parents passing away, was Hillary losing. I'm not over it. So I'm just not over it. I don't have anything original to say. She would have been an incredible president. The things that she had to overcome and had to deal with, first ever things, Russian hacking, I mean, fake news, sexism, the things that happened were so extraordinary.
Emails and Comey and...
It was the perfect storm.
And then Trump getting free coverage to any extent.
It was a perfect storm, you know? And as far as I'm concerned, she turned in three perfect debate performances, totally knew why she wanted to be president, why she should be president. And most of the people in the country agreed with that. So I'm not over it. I'm not young. And it did reinvigorate me after she lost, after I couldn't get out of bed for 2 weeks or whatever, and was crying, literally sobbing. It did make me really double down on what I wanted to do with iVote, our organization, because—
When was iVote started?
It was started before that. Jeremy Bird and I co-founded it in 2013, a year before the 2014 terrible midterm.
How did you get to know Jeremy? Where does that relationship start?
Well, Jeremy was field director for Barack Obama, and I just knew him casually. But basically, I called him and asked to meet with him and talk to him about this idea that I had that secretaries of state were doing some really terrible things and that the Republicans had figured this out.
The voter suppression work that they've been doing out of that office all over the country.
Yeah, it's been going on for a long time. Yeah. It's just starting to get some coverage.
Right, because Ohio was doing it a long time ago.
That was Jeremy's experience because he had worked on 2008 and 2012, and he was talking about the difference between when we had Jennifer Bruner in 2008 and when we had John Husted in 2012. But I'd been really witnessing it firsthand because I ran a couple of Secretaries of State campaigns and I was involved in a couple of Secretaries of State campaigns. And of course, this all starts back to the 2000 election when we lost the presidential campaign because of a Secretary of State. And then I think 2004, we lost the presidential campaign because of a Secretary of State. Because Secretaries of State, as some people are now learning, have so much power. It's like I like to say it's the least sexy, most powerful office in the country.
Electorally, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Republicans saw this as an opening, just like they saw that they should take over state legislative chambers when we were so focused on Senate and governor, and we had to be in presidentials. They saw this as an opening. They ran a national, well-funded, coordinated campaign to win the secretaries of state offices. And you know what they did? In 2014, in the swing states, we only had Nevada, which we lost in 14. iVote ran a campaign there and we were the top of the ticket, but we still lost because it was such a devastating year.
What was the animating idea then for iVote?
The animating idea, meaning the...
Well, what's the founding story there?
Founding story is that if we believe that every eligible citizen should be able to vote and that our democracy would be stronger, everybody knew there was such a thing as voter suppression. Pre-iVote, basically people would just say, oh, there's voter suppression and try to raise money from it. We decided to go on the offense and make lemonade out of lemons by being for the things that we know increase voting. things like automatic voter registration, same-day registration, vote at home, and elect people to these offices that would implement all these methods and policies that increase voting, and actually who wouldn't do all the bad stuff. So like Brian Kemp, you know, people are now familiar with this, finally, some people, because of Stacey Abrams and what happened in Georgia with Brian Kemp. But I like to say if I saw Brian Kemp on the street now, I don't know if I'd punch him in the face or hug him.
Because he brought cheating to light in a certain way?
This has been happening. This is why we formed iVote. He is not the only Republican Secretary of State to do this.
Maybe and you should do both if you see him.
Yeah, like just like hug him and punch him. And like, I don't know what. I was just like, I was really worried because actually the governor's conference was in the same hotel that I was staying in. And I, really this thought was going through my mind, like, because he's brought this awareness that didn't exist before and that we were single-handedly trying to bring to the country. Hey, you know, these secretaries of state are purging people arbitrarily off the registration rolls. You know all those registration drives that you hold that you're trying so hard to get 10 people in a supermarket to register? Well, guess what? Once these people are elected, they're just being like, okay, those 20,000 people, oh, there's too many Gonzalez's on the list. We're just going to purge them right off. And the purging story was not being told until the Stacey Abrams, Brian Kemp 2018.
Why'd you call it iVote?
Jeremy and I decided to name it, and we were just like texting back and forth, asking people, and I think he named it iVote. We went through a lot of iterations of something with vote in it, and it was his idea.
So you're not really clear on what that name means.
It means, I mean.
Does it mean I?
Yeah, I get think to we're vote, tr- I exactly. Be, yeah. We're trying. We were short, trying to make a shorter, cooler version of I will be able to vote.
So, and what is the mission? Like, how focused is it on Secretary of State races? What
the
is the scope of what you do?
The main mission is to elect Democratic. Or if you find me a Republican, I'd probably be for them, Secretary of State who believes in actual voting. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's going to spend their time as a nonpartisan administrator of elections doing all the things they can to increase participation. That's their job. And who's not going to do, you know, refuses to do.
Not going to act like a Republican political operative.
Voter suppression is part of their game plan to win. It is. They know that their constituency does not constitute the majority in a lot of places, and that to stay in power, they have to stop certain people from voting. And I really believe this. This is what their strategy is.
Well, and they've been recorded saying this fairly straightforwardly in multiple places, right?
And whether they were recorded or not, you can see it in their actions. Like, before Trump made Kris Kobach famous, he was only a lowly Secretary of State in Kansas, but he was the thought leader for the modern day. I mean, voter suppression is not new. We all understand this, right? Like, it's been going on. It's like racism is not new. I mean, Alexander Kazar wrote the best book on this, The History of Voter Suppression. And, you know, it started when the country was formed. Landowners could vote and renters could not. It goes on and on. But there is a modern day Jim Crow, you know, the last 15 years. And working on these Secretary of State races and in the part of campaigns that have to do with participation, I was just outraged because I know all the work being done by people in the country to try to get people to vote, because a lot of people feel so disconnected from the political system that they don't bother voting. And you see that when you're an organizer, when you're working out there, it's directly correlated to income, which is nuts. So we want a country where the richer you are, you participate. And if you're poor and you need government even more, you don't, because government isn't speaking to you. So because I have so much admiration for all the different organizations trying to get young people, poor people, people who don't have any connection to the politics involved, it pissed me off beyond belief to see these elected officials using the powers of their office to basically rig the vote. They're rigging the vote. They're picking their voters instead of letting voters pick their leaders. And it's so infuriating to me. Then when Trump won and he put that fake voter commission together, where he, and he put Chris Kobach as head, I think that was like, I'm working 7 days now. I'm not even taking Sunday nights off, because to me, that was the committee to reelect Donald Trump. So it was just so outrageously.
It's amazing how badly it was done that it kind of unraveled.
Oh, like unlike everything else he's done?
Yeah.
Like, what
but
is he?
You think he would put some, you know, that someone would be hired and do a little bit better job.
Well, when you're basing everything on a bunch of lies, I mean, it's like, how are you going to run something well that says that there was voter fraud when there wasn't? It's all based on lies. I mean, the real problem is voter participation. There's not one person, there's not one study, there's not one fact that corroborates that the real problem is fraud. That's just a bunch of bullshit.
How big is iVote? Can you size yourself?
We're going to be expanding, but in this last election cycle, so we were a swing state, elect Democratic secretaries of state operation, and we worked in 7 states, but we targeted 3 states and spent millions and millions of dollars there, and we won all of those. We didn't win the ones that we couldn't afford.
Which were the ones that you won, the three?
We won 3 elections that we worked on. One was an independent expenditure campaign not coordinated with the candidate, Jocelyn Benson, in Michigan. Jocelyn Benson, who's probably the country's authority in every way on voting rights. I'm so proud to have run this independent campaign to help elect her. And then we also ran an independent campaign to help elect Jenna Griswold, who won in Colorado. But then we went whole hog in Arizona, which is my favorite story to tell, because we now have a Democratic Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, in Arizona for the first time in a very, very long time. I used to know exactly when their last one was, but it's a very long time. And she's also lieutenant governor. So she's top Democrat in the state of Arizona. And she was running against a guy named Steve Gaynor, who literally made Brian Kemp look moderate. He is a right-wing guy who self-funded his own campaign to the tune of millions of dollars. I mean, a lot of times our candidates have a lot of trouble raising money. That's one of the big reasons that we don't win.
It's a low visibility race in general, right?
Low visibility. Usually they're starting out from like a state senator's office or even not a politician, and they're trying to run a statewide race that they need to raise television money. So Katie Hobbs is now Secretary of State in Arizona. And this is my favorite story because she completely believes in participation. There is not going to be any purging of Gonzalez's in Arizona. And in Arizona is on everyone's short list of states that are battleground for 220. I mean, how do you get to 270 without Arizona these days? We need it. And we're not going to have to worry that we have one of these operatives installed, like the Republicans install their operatives, who would do everything possible. Our opponent in that campaign said he was going to stop printing ballots in Spanish. He's so right-wing. He would have used cross-check Chris Kobach's system to remove eligible citizens from the rolls. And Katie's not only not doing all those terrible things, she's already working on reaching out to voters to try to create a climate that her office is, you know, not only in charge of cybersecurity and the registration rolls, but reaching out to citizens to try to bring them into the world of participating in the electoral process. So I'm super proud of that.
What was it that you added to that campaign that helped make a difference? What was the argument that was made? How did she win that?
Well, first of all, we spent $3.4 million on a Secretary of State race. And I forget the total number she had raised. She did a great job. She had a great campaign manager named Niles Harris, and she was a great candidate. So it wasn't like we were starting with bupkas. Like, we had this great person who believed in our mission. And in Arizona, in the last cycle, we were allowed to work with the Democratic Party. And so we, together with the campaign and the Democratic Party, created digital ads and ads that were showing Katie's background and her accomplishments and how she deserved to hold this statewide office of lieutenant governor and secretary of state. And we did make a contrast ad or two, too.
Sounds like there was a lot of fodder for that.
Yeah, yeah, there was.
Are those two separate offices that she ran for both? How
in,
did it work?
No, I've never in heard of Arizona, anyone being both. In Arizona, the Secretary of State's also the Lieutenant Governor. And as a matter of fact, many times in recent history, the governor has decided to run for something or retired or something from Bruce Babbitt. I think there's a lot of examples of this, and they become governor. So she's the top Democrat in the state, and she was the Senate minority leader. And she has a very short period of time has racked up an impressive set of accomplishments of doing things to help people. She is in politics for all the right reasons, and I'm just proud to have helped her. She helped herself, obviously, but we gave her a nice assist.
Who do you find to be your best allies in these fights in the Secretary of State world?
I think one of the jobs of iVote that we've accomplished or have done quite a bit, there's still more to go, is that we saw ourselves as an organization and a PAC that wanted to educate the public about the importance of this office. So I feel like where we started 5 years ago, we've made so much progress, because when we first started, people were like, what? Like, secretaries of state run elections? You mean states are like, I literally have had people say to me, so there's no like national laws, like states run their own elections. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Harvard and MIT are there. I travel amongst very educated people. And when I tell them that elections are literally run by partisan Republican hacks in all the swing states, and that there's no national law that they have to adhere to, that they have so much power and so much control in every aspect of how they administer the election, they can't believe it. Like, this is all this stuff is new, I think, to the American public, talking about democracy and, you know, whether it be gerrymandering or secretaries of states and their power, it's new. We ran a public campaign on how important this office is. And is it still on top of people's minds? No, not right now. But was it during the Georgia Stacey Abrams thing? Yes. Are we all done educating people? No, but we put a little dent in it. And I'm really super proud of that.
Where do you find funding for this kind of work?
Anywhere we got. You got any money? I'd probably ask you after the interview. we look everywhere for funding. We have, you know, one-offs. A famous person will help us have a small event or introduce us to a big donor. The funding isn't easy, and we're trying to build a small dollar list like every other organization. And we think we should be much stronger in that regard by the next time the swing state secretaries of state are up. I think it's getting a little bit easier because people are finally getting that voter suppression is real and that it's a big part of how they're winning. And I think people don't want to lose the presidential or the governor's or the state legislative races, and they don't want to lose because of cheating and rigging. It's just a fairness thing.
Yeah.
So
have you run across Let America Vote?
I'm on the board of Let America Vote. So, Jason, yeah. And he's on the board of iVote.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
What do you think of the work they're doing?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're working in the state legislative spaces. And Jason is out of all the politicians in the country, and Stacey Abrams, like two of the top leaders. I'm not a politician. He's been a wonderful, amazing, what is it called, a bullhorn for
advocate,
the problem.
Yeah, he's
Yeah, he gets it.
He's very eloquent about it. He was actually my first guest like 200 and some episodes ago.
I launched the podcast with an interview with him. He's an amazing human being. So he also, when we first started iVote, he was Secretary of State in Missouri. And I got to know him because he came and did a town hall or two for iVote. And that's how we got to know each other. And I was like, he gets this. Like, he got the whole premise and the whole reason it was important immediately.
That office.
Yeah, but a lot of people have that office and they didn't have the foresight that Jason did.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's special.
The DNC has some kind of group on voter suppression. Are you aware of that? What do you think they're up to?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked at the DNC. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say anything negative, but I will say that the DNC is cyclical. So, like, sometimes it's a broken bank account with nothing in it, and sometimes it's got money. And they have 150 different agendas. I think it's very important to have an outside group like iVote because we're focused and our mission is on two things right now. We might expand to three, but one thing is electing Democratic Secretary of States who will not stop certain people from voting. And the other is we put automatic voter registration on the ballot in Nevada in 2014. It took 4 years and we passed it with a group of partners in 2018. And we've been working it on automatic voter registration as well as Secretaries of State as one of the methods that is the way to increase turnout. Because if you automatically register people and you can start talking to them immediately about the issues instead of about the process, your turnout's going to be greater. And we're proving that in Oregon right now.
Registration is such an artificial waste of energy in this day and age. There should be able to vote if you're eligible.
For somebody who spent their entire life in voter registration, I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post in October where I called for the end of registration. And that is my mission, my personal mission in life. So I do not think we should have registration. I think that registration is the problem. It's the barrier to voting. And I don't see why we need it. I think we should just have a system. Other countries do this, like a database, like eligible citizens, like the way we do selective service. And you're just registered. When you turn 18,
there should be a federal system.
Federal system, you'd have to do nothing. You do nothing. You're just registered when you're 18, and then you're on a list that's you're an eligible citizen, and you go to your polling place and you vote. So there should be no registration, and we go right to voting.
Are you doing any of the 2019 races or into 2020?
So I'm sad to say that I can't completely tell you all of our plans because we have a board meeting coming up and we're just right now working out our campaign plans. And some of it, there's no swing state secretaries of state races coming up in 2020. There are a few smaller states that have secretaries of state races, and we are going to be expanding into those. We have been working with the House and Senate leadership on HR1. Automatic voter registration is part of that. We are looking at what specific campaigns we're going to do, and we'll be announcing them sometime in later spring. But we are going to continue to build, to recruit, and train, and run campaigns for the swing state secretaries of state, the battleground states, and all the states' secretaries of state, and continue to look for places where we can work on passing reforms like automatic voter registration, vote at home, vote by mail. And we're going to be announcing some new things too. We're not there yet.
I talked to someone who was running the Democratic Attorney General's Association, also a very important position in every state, especially when you need to fight the administration. One thing that I remember from that is that they were providing resources, not just electoral, but also once you were in office, trying to share information that would make it easier to do the job as Attorney General. Is that something that you guys do in the Secretary of State world?
No, but that is something that we didn't have any Democratic Secretaries of State in swing states until this cycle. So we are now talking about how we can better assist the secretaries that we just helped elect get their word out. They don't need help running their office. They're stars. But we're trying to figure out how we can help them.
Do you take a look at what the other side is up to, the Republicans on the in the secretary? What do they have?
Well, that's what drove me. Like, originally was...
Do they have a special group that works on Secretary of State? Or how do they, on that side,
organize? They have
many.
You know, some of this is C4, so you can't really tell exactly. But I know Jason tells the story of that when he was running in Missouri, that a Republican group came in October. And I forget the number, but it was like in the six-figure number, and dumped all this money on him on advertising. And so that's what they've done. I think it's been through the Republican State Legislative Caucus, and then there's a few PACs that they have run by Republican operators. And then it's the normal Republican rich person player guys that they can just spend a million. Like, they didn't need to because we didn't have a million to spend, but they were definitely the normal suspects funding these offices. I was watching it, and they figured out that presidential elections are close. They're just close. They are. That we can expect them to be close. So if you can rob us of a seat from 28,000 votes, you might just have won yourself a president.
I think it's pretty clear that Democrats would have carried Wisconsin, for example, in 2016 without the voter suppression that took place up there, right?
No Secretary of State there, though. They have a very different system. But Michigan,
but that was done
I would like to say that I feel confident that if Jocelyn Benson had been Secretary of State in Michigan, that those 27,000 votes, first of all, she's already like running around the state, going to every county and precinct, talking about the office, not just, you know, because the Secretary of State does business services too, but like doing outreach. Like, this is what these people should be doing. They should be trying to help people, eligible citizens, to vote, not just putting up this hurdle, this blockade. Oh, we closed those polling stations. Didn't you hear? You know, oh, they happen to be in all black neighborhoods, you know. Oh, you can only register at the DMV. Oh, guess what? The DMV is closed in all the places. And oh, guess what? Those are actually where all the black people live. It's just, it's so obvious that this was their strategy to win. It's not going to give them 20 points, but 1, 2, 3 percentage points, that's enough to sway every presidential, lots of governor's races.
So where would you like iVote to be in a few years down the road after like the 2022 cycle?
In the 2022 cycle, I'd like to win all the Secretary of State races. We won 3. We had enough resources to, where we had enough resources to play big, we won. I'd like to have enough resources to play in all of them, to reelect our voting rights champions, and then to go into the other states that we just didn't have enough resources to really run a whole statewide campaign. And then I'm just hoping that the country is really changing on all these issues and people are becoming more and more and more aware. And we did see a big change in that automatic voter registration is something that, this is a true story. In 2014, I could not get one candidate for the office of Secretary of State to say the words. They thought it was radical. So
doesn't feel radical at all.
It's just how sometimes things change fast. Mm-hmm. And now it's part of the Democratic Party platform.
Yeah.
And all of these issues about voter suppression have come to so much light in the last 2 years. I can only imagine if it keeps going at this rate, that maybe we won't need iVote. But I think we probably will still always need an iVote.
The worms does seem to turn pretty often in politics.
Yeah. We're trying to spend these next couple years building something that will last. You know, last past when the founding members of this organization were here, and something that can always make sure that while we're electing partisan people to these offices that run elections, that they're people that believe that everyone should vote. Every eligible citizen, whether you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, let the chips fall where they may. Make it easier for people to vote. I'd like to go from no registration to mandatory or universal voting. But that's my vision for the future.
Ellen, lovely to talk to you. Anything else you want to say?
Nope. Just want to thank all the people out there who are working hard every single day to make the country better, because I know a lot of them and they're amazing.
What a nice way to end. Thank you very much. That was Ellen Kurz with iVote. She's at ivoteforamerica.org. I hope that iVote will make a big difference by electing more secretaries of state who are committed to help Americans vote. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.